Joined today by Matt Davey, Roy Chua, Ed Ballas.
Yep, Ed Ballas.
Ed Ballas, great. And Matt Palmer. We are in about halfway through the first day. Some of us have been here for the past couple days. So we got Matt Davey. Matt, tell everybody who you are and where they can find you.
Okay, so my name is Matt Davey. I'm with TALAC Networks. You can find us at TALAC.com, TALLAC.com.
Roy?
I'm Roy Chua from Wiretap Ventures and SDN Central, and you can find us online at wiretapventures.com or sdncentral.com.
Right. Ed?
Hi, I'm Ed Bayless. I'm from the Global NOC at Indiana University. You can reach us at globalnoc.iu.edu.
Mr. Palmer.
And I'm Matt Palmer with Wiretap Ventures and SDN Central. And as Roy said, you can find us at wiretapventures.com or sdncentral.com.
Great. Vincent Cerf coming in on a helicopter was pretty funny.
It was pretty cool. That was pretty cool. I think the best part of this morning was actually seeing Nick McCowan dress up as James Bond. I think he looks just like Daniel Craig. And I think that was probably the best part of this morning, for me anyway.
Yeah, so he came in looking like, dressed up like James Bond, and he really does look like
James
Bond. He
does look like Daniel Craig.
Anyways, what do you think about it, Matt?
Well, yeah, I thought the highlight for me was probably the daylight presentation. It was good to finally see, you know, sort of from the horse's mouth, what was going on with daylight. I thought the rationale he laid out was really great, right? I mean, all the key points about why they were doing it, and of course, you know, pointing out, you know, we're just gonna have to watch what happens, right? I think the proof is in the pudding. You know, next year this time we'll have probably a lot more to reflect on whether that actually worked out or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the meritocracy piece is kind of a key there with an open source project, and I mean, so the IBM chair. Did anybody catch his name? I forgot it.
Yeah.
So whoever the chair of Daylight is, he's from IBM, so there's obviously a lot of speculation that Cisco's going to dominate it. But in reality, IBM has
just as much play.
Tens of thousands
yes.
of software developers have been waiting around since the 90s to actually do this. Yeah, what'd you think about it?
I think to add on to your piece, I mean, one of the things that we've tracked on SDN Central and we've been tracking throughout our careers is that IBM has led an awful lot of open source projects and an awful lot of open source initiatives. And so, I mean, as everyone is saying, you know, we have to wait and see the proof will be in the pudding, et cetera. You know, our sense is that it doesn't feel like it's going to be dominated by one vendor. There may be a collection of vendors, but it doesn't feel like it's going to be dominated by one vendor.
No, I agree with Matt. I think, you know, the way IBM has masterfully led and crafted and directed the Eclipse project, the Eclipse Foundation, I think, you know, that's just, and I think, proof that they know how to do it. They can do it, and I think with the cooperation of the rest of the vendors, I think that they will be able to do it.
Yeah, you know, the one question I would have is, you know, looking at the Daylight website and at the wiki, you know, what you see is a lot of contributions from Cisco. When you look at the contributors there, the code that's there, the documentation.
That is true. It looks just like Beacon.
Look a little bit, and there seemed to be a disconnect from what I saw on the website to what he was saying in the presentation this morning. You know, he was saying Q3 release of code. Well, there's already code up there. What does that mean? He was saying, you know, the technical committee is going to decide what code goes in, and they're hashing it over. But there's code and documentation already there. So there seemed to be a disconnect to me there, and you know, I wanted some explanation for why that was.
That's,
I didn't hear
that's
that.
True. Well, I think, and now understanding, Matt, is that that Cisco is contributing the core to the controller itself. And so it's no surprise that the controller platform, at least to us, is from Cisco, and that the rest of the vendors will add on to that.
Yeah.
So I think we'll see the other contributions, because that's the first thing that has to be there, obviously, is the controller platform.
Yeah.
And then you add things below and things above it. So I mean, I think that's partially no surprise. I don't know, Matt, what do you think?
I fully agree with you, Roy.
That's very rare, by the way. So what does it mean for Internet 2?
Yeah,
nice programming background from your take on it. I assume you've probably played with Beacon, which is clearly...
Yeah. I mean, and we've actually... the application that we run in production right now is based on Knox, and so we are looking in the next year or so probably to you know, refactor that into something a little more modern. At this stage, you know, the jury's out for me yet. We're still, you know, we've evaluated things a few months back. We're still, you know, looking at the Daylight stuff and other controllers, you know, trying to keep an open mind right now, and just because, you know, there tends to be a lot of hype with these releases and all that. And so I just try to not get too emotionally attached to anything prematurely at this stage. So that's kind of where we're at, but we are, you know, I'm we are very interested to see where this goes, because we have to make a decision here at some point next year.
So you mentioned Knox, so C-based compiled versus something more interpreted along the lines of Java, or well, compiled through OSGI and Maven. What are you? Do you have any concerns from C versus Java perspective there?
Yes, I do have concerns. My disposition is that I think Java could be suitable, and obviously a lot of people think that as well. My comfort level would be if it were in something in C. Although, with that said, also, you know, there's a lot of ways of making it language neutral in terms of the inter-process communication and sort of abstraction layers. So, the number one thing is to make sure that it's manageable in production and that it's stable and secure and those kind of things. And those are the typical concerns. I'm not, I tend to be a pragmatist in terms of language choice.
So while we're kind of on OpenFlow, I didn't hear a whole lot of OpenFlow today, but I still don't know how else you would do any of this without OpenFlow. I think Roy and Matt and I were laughing yesterday because, as we all know, OpenFlow is merely a messaging protocol that sends an instruction to a switch, and the switch knows what to do with it.
That is correct.
So we're thinking, let's use Twitter.
That's correct. we'll be submitting to the ONF a spec for doing flow-based mods over Twitter. Exactly. I mean, it's not that far from the XMPP protocol with Jabber users, right? I mean, it's the same thing. And that way we could get a highly distributed worldwide global controller, because one tweet, in sub-milliseconds will get across the world.
The distributed systems are already...
Absolutely. It's highly robust.
They solved all the hard problems.
That's right. There you go. The ecosystem is very robust for Twitter.
Web 2.0 compliant.
Web 2.0 compliant, multiple devices, multiple clients.
Integrated. I like the fact that my iPad, that I can just go to any app on my iPad and I can be able to configure this.
That's correct. Absolutely.
So does anybody see... Have we heard any alternatives to OpenFlow and SDN? Are they still coupled?
I would say that what we're hearing around SDN is more around the programmatic elements than the actual protocol itself. And so what we're seeing is a lot of vendors now exposing other abstractions on top of their switches or their switch OSs, and allowing you to, programming access certain fundamentals, right? For instance, taking the routes that exist today and modifying the routing table, right? So similar to... I2RS, right? So I think they are now classifying any programmatic access or any programmatic API through automation interfaces to their OSs or equipment as now SDN. And that's obviously this northbound aspect of it as opposed to any southbound interfaces. But no, we haven't heard of any sort of southbound replacements to OpenFlow. Not anyway.
There was this thing called Twitter Flow, but that...
Twitter Flow, patent pending, not yet, that's right. Yeah.
I think that makes sense. I mean, although some of it is the, SDNification or whatever they call it.
SDN washing.
SDN washing, excuse me, yeah. It's a continuum of whether or not, it's sort of like, when you write applications today, do you write in assembler? Or do you write in C or an interpreted language? And it's the same thing when you're controlling a network. Do you need to have direct low-level forwarding control, or are there other abstraction layers that might be more suitable and sufficiently... There are times where that abstraction and not being as specific as having the individual flow rules is probably advantageous. And so I think that it makes sense that the vendors would be looking at that saying, okay, it's SDN is more than just OpenFlow, but at its lowest level right now, OpenFlow pretty much is,
When it comes to actually programming a network app, I know I'm not exactly a great programmer, but I can program apps because it's really simple to do it. So I've got a method of instantiating flow. So now all I have to worry about is matching some traffic and having an action.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to worry about labels, tags, TE, OSPF, the proverbial bag of protocols. Does that simplicity make sense? And does it only belong on the edge? Or?
That simplicity is also a little, I think, what I've seen in our networks, it becomes a little misleading because for instance, on the Internet 2 network, the Advanced Layer 2 service is, 100 gig nationwide, completely open flow controlled network. At the edges, everybody else is not. And so controlling what tags are on the egresses and ingresses and whether or not even, the things up above matter at that point, right? So the frames and the content of those frames matters.
Well, Internet 2 is so unique that you're doing is you're focusing on aggregation, whereas in a campus environment or enterprise environment, what I'm focusing on is the edge.
Yeah.
If it goes into an if I'm not classified by that point, I'm at that edge. Well, your edge, though, is your PE at the provider.
Yeah,
so
right.
It's really the service provider. Because if you're not classified at that point, you put into an LSP or an IAP or a PGP path, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I think there seems to be some confusion over tunnels. So tunnels in the data center are no different from an LSP in the service provider.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Just let it drain into the native IGP. That's fixing an application problem, which is layer 2 vMotion and live workload migration. So do you want to maybe get into how, I'd love for to hear how you're actually, because Internet 2 is actually doing this for real, you're doing it in production.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You said Knox, which
scares me. Yeah.
That's
so
completely uncompilable.
Well,
for the general common man.
Well, we've got a team of folks that have done a lot of development work in the past, so it's not that big of a deal. So in terms of the software stack that we've got today, and I should stress that it's just today, we have plans to sort of evolve this. But where we're at today is obviously we're doing OpenFlow 1.0. We're using Knox. We developed an abstraction layer that sits on top of that because we knew even at the time that we were doing that we may want to, the controller space is just so sort of in flux. So we have actually, oddly, a DBus abstraction layer. We plan on moving to something along the lines of sort of like a RabbitMQ, something like that, that we can then do distributed, that would give us the ability to distribute communications rather easily. But on top of that abstraction layer, then we have a bunch of business logic that implements this layer 2 service. So the layer 2 service is essentially just a simple point-to-point or point-to-multipoint VLAN service with primary and backup paths, and this system monitors the network looking for topology issues or, link downs, that kind of thing, and then we'll automatically restore to a backup path or from the backup path to the primary, that kind of thing. And on top of that, sort of the forwarding control engine is a user interface. So the one of the main drivers for us was to make a really simple user interface that a researcher could come into, pick their endpoints on a graphical map so they know, okay, just go to Chicago, go to New York, and it's, an intuitive sort of frame of reference in the geographic context. They go in there, they pick their endpoints, they define what they want the tags to be, and then they pick a path, or the system will pick the path for them. And then they hit go, and you've got connectivity at that point.
And
they don't have to call the knock or anything. They can do this, in the middle of the night if they wanted to. So.
And you're doing this in a multi-vendor environment, right?
Yes, yes, absolutely.
I mean, that seems like to be one of the key. You're really actually having
Yes, Internet 2 has really been trying to push the bounds here, and much to the dismay of my team, because it adds a lot of complexity. But it's actually a very useful exercise for us, for everybody involved. We actually do have two vendors right now that are providing 100 gig Ethernet switches, and there are other vendors that we're evaluating as we speak. And the idea is we really want to stick with the spirit of a protocol adherence. And so we want to ensure that what we do and implement is actually adhering to the protocol, and they're not using some sort of sideband channel to work around something, those kind of things. So,
that's great.
That's cool. I'd love to hear about how, so you talked about failover. There's been a lot of talk on, OpenFlow 1.0 doesn't support batch speed routing.
Right.
So things with multi tables. Sounds like yours are probably putting in priority based backup packs.
Well, so what we've actually done is not quite that. What we do is we do have a sort of a primary backup path that are pre-configured, and what we do is when we detect a network issue that's going to disrupt traffic on the primary, let's say, we actually signal to the edges, go to the backup path. So it's just two flow mods, one to each endpoint, and then that diverts traffic. We have been putting a fair amount of analysis into sort of how we go from that to how we really get, so that, today, failover is on the order of a couple seconds, something like that. And what we really need to do is get that down to, say, on the order of 100 to 50. Yeah, we'd love to be able to compete with MPLS is really what we see as the gold standard.
And do you think OpenFlow 1.3 gets you to that place? It's the right stuff there? And I'm curious, too, how fast do you think you get there? Is that early next year? What's your feel for that?
So there are some constructs in the 1.3 spec that look like they would allow us to do some of that, to get us to actually very closely mimic the fast failover capabilities of MPLS. The challenges that we've seen is when working with vendors, and this is all vendors, and we work with even vendors that are sort of don't even have 100 gig offerings, we've seen some issues in terms of their how quickly they can get sort of flow modifications into their forwarding tables, and then also issues with their ability to basically detect a link down and then report that back to the controller. And, those have been improving over time. All the vendors have been working very diligently on this, and things are improving and they will improve. So as they mature, this will naturally improve. We've also been looking at the fundamental nature of how we actually communicate and issues like, will a central controller work? Do you need to have a distributed controller? And, you know, some of our analysis indicates that, you know, even in a central controller situation, we can have significant improvements over what we have today, even without the 1.3. But the 1.3 certainly offers us some capabilities there. I think it was with the port groups, I think they called, that allows us to do some very interesting things. So the first step is to really get them to use AL2S as a backhaul into that existing Layer 3 infrastructure. One of the other things we're doing right now is we're actually looking at how to do network virtualization, slicing, multi-tenancy, however you want to describe it, with this nationwide fabric. So we are looking at things like FlowVisor and how you might slice this to protect, you know, so we have this existing AL2S service. One of the other things we may be doing and are actively looking at is other services we could provide on the same OpenFlow-based fabric. And one of them would be, yes. I mean, you could have route service, some sort of a route, you know, internet exchange type model where, yes, you have the traditional Layer 3 service, but there could be more sort of specific purpose, you know, Layer 3 capable services built, you know, using OpenFlow.
That's so cool.
And so that right now, you know, where we're at is there are several sort of parties out there that are looking at, you know, how to do this. And as those mature, you know, our hope is to start vetting these. One of the other interesting things actually about Internet 2 is that while they have this 100 gig network, they also have a 10 gig nationwide network as well. It's smaller in scale, and the idea is that we can, for more risky things, we can try out those on the 10 gig nationwide NEC network. And so the plan is to really, you know, try out these ideas, provide a platform for innovation where people can experiment. You know, of course, it is a production network, and so one of the inherent tensions we have is we need to provide, you know, production quality stability, and yet we want to be innovative. And so that's an inherent tension for us to manage. And so we, you know, look at things like FlowVisor or other techniques for basically providing that control. And then the other thing we do is we bring in these experimental applications. We would bring them in sort of to our lab first and then into sort of the what we call the NDDI network, this 10 gig network. And then from there, if everything's proved stable, then they might graduate up into the 100 gig network. And so there's a progression there. But really what we see is as these apps mature, we want to get them into the network. And especially if they're useful to researchers in our community or people, just anybody that needs to move traffic in our community, we're interested in making that happen.
Very cool.
Matt, would you want to talk maybe, I know you've done a lot over the years and a lot of leadership in the enterprise space with SDN and OpenFlow. So you've taken a new role.
Right? Yeah.
Maybe tell us about that.
Yeah, sure. It's
gone to the dark side.
I have gone to the dark side. After almost 14 years at the university, pretty much my whole career, about 4 weeks ago, I left and joined a new company called Talak Networks, fairly early stage startup company. So we're, if you look at our website, you'll see we're doing a lot of sort of training and consulting around SDN. A lot of the company has their background in the HP ProCurve, HP networking division. And so very, very, very deep bench. It's funny to come to a company and be the guy with the least experience at 17 years in the industry on the team. So really deep bench there. People with great experience. So bringing that to really take SDN to the mainstream. You know, it feels, you know, I've been in this for over 3-4 years now doing SDN, but really I think we're still just kind of the tip of the iceberg, and there's still a lot of people that need to get ramped up on this. So doing education, we're both sort of end user focused. So you'll see if you look at our website, we're doing a training in June in Singapore alongside the Layer 123's conference over there, helping them out at their October conference as well. We have some webinars that'll be coming posting here soon, which we're excited about putting together. And we're also doing kind of a launch of some technology, so we're also looking at some licensable technology as well. So it's exciting. We're actually doing a launch here this week. We have some demos of kind of some initial pieces of the product that we've been working on, so it's kind of fun.
Nice. Matt, Roy, what use cases are you guys seeing in the enterprise? I know we've talked about this quite a bit, and I tend to see management as the number one problem we have. We've been through that transition of wireless controllers into a centralized management model.
Yeah, I think in the enterprise, what we're seeing primarily, a couple of use cases. I think the first one, first and foremost, is network virtualization, both slicing the network, I think as Ed was talking about, and stretching the network as well. And so this is the concept of a private data center. They want to have their own Amazon or their own rack space internally. And the goal of providing that kind of cloud data center is to reduce the amount of spend they have on not just the networking part, but the server and the storage portion of it, so the compute and storage portion as well. And network virtualization is viewed as a way to more efficiently share the resources that they have within the cloud data centers, private or hybrid, and make that available on a per-department basis or a per-workgroup basis or per-application team basis, right? So that's what we're seeing around network virtualization. I think that's one aspect we're seeing. We're also seeing SDN being looked at for visibility troubleshooting. And I think, you know, you've seen just about every major vendor now talk about a tapping app or a tap. So everything is, you know, a big tap, a small tap, a little tap, a, you know, whatever it is, right? And I think fundamentally, I mean, Cisco has a tab, Arista has a tab, right?
You're not talking about beer here, right?
No, not.
Where there would be an open flow.
That's right, not that kind of open flow, exactly. Right, absolutely. And so I think, you know, fundamentally the visibility and troubleshooting aspects around that we're seeing as well. And more so than just the virtual, sort of the virtual multi-tenancy, we're also seeing a need to stretch their network fabric across data centers, across the WAN, as it were, across racks, across data centers. So I think that, that virtualization, that visibility aspects around the enterprise side of the equation is what we're seeing for the most part. It contrasts a little bit differently with the carriers and the service providers that we talk to and we work with. They all obviously they have a data center problem as well, solving the network, you know, multi-tenancy issue. But on top of that, you know, what we hear quite often is service chaining, the concept of virtualizing these layer 47 services and then making them available so that, you know, on a per-client or per-flow basis, you can chain in your firewalls, your IDSs, your IPS, you know, pick your favorite security appliance and chain that through.
So it seems like that's also an enterprise play as well.
It's also an enterprise play. Yes, we've also seen talk about the enterprises, but I think the service providers, you know, seem to want to provide that as a service, right? As a service, exactly. Obviously. I think that's one aspect of it. And along with service chaining, I think you've got to talk about network function virtualization, right, in the SP space, which is, you know, which I think is a simple, I think it's probably a complex white paper to describe virtualization of network services, right? That's basically what it comes down to. Let's take a physical box and put it in the VM. I think that's, I mean, obviously there's a lot of specs, a lot of configuration, frameworks, and plug-in interfaces you need to deal with. But fundamentally, it's take a physical box and move it into virtual. And along with NFV, it's not so much even service chaining, but moving, we're hearing talk about using SDN to help move these physical boxes, your Evolved Packet Core, right? Pick a BRAS, your favorite big iron boxes, and moving them onto x86 type architectures or ARM or MIPS architectures, you know, your commodity architectures. I think that's what we're seeing as well.
And so do you think the tie-in, it seems to me the tie-in with OpenFlow there is being able to steer the traffic to the right boxes.
That is correct. I mean, OpenFlow and SDN, yes.
Totally fit together. I mean,
it is.
NFV and SDN
it is.
Fit together.
It is. They are actually, I wouldn't say they're one and the same, but they're sort of related.
Yeah.
So I think next year we'll start coining the term, you know, SDN and NFV. Can say that quickly, and I think if we say that fast enough, it will actually melt together.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
You know, to add to Roy's point, you know, back to Roy listed a lot of good use cases of what we're seeing, and you know, in terms of prioritization, you know, where we see, you know, where we see the customers asking the questions, and where we see the vendors spending their time, is, you know, I like to oversimplify it, so I'll put it in a 2x2 matrix, and if we go, you know. Go, where is there the most number of potential customers? It gets back to what Roy's point was on, you know, network virtualization, service chaining, and tapping. And then if you sort of take another axis and you sort of go, you know, so you start with most and least number of customers, and then you start with, you know, what is mission critical and what's important, you start to realize that visibility and tapping fit into important, meaning that it sits in somebody's roadmap, they have budget for it, and that they could actually start with a new technology, a new product, because it's not mission critical, and if it blows up, the world doesn't end.
Yeah,
And we kind of see network virtualization being the same thing because it's greenfield. It's a new implementation. Mm-hmm. Expectations are still low for those implementations.
That's true.
And the same thing for a service provider because today they're not able to service chain as a service. So for them, it's something that's new.
That's right.
But back to Roy's point, Matt, to yours about, you know, service chain in the enterprise. We've worked with a number of enterprises who asked us to look at it. And then when you start talking about, well, here's what we're going to do to your security services. Whoa, hold on there, Trigger. we got a lot more work here to do. Yeah. And by the way, it doesn't have to do with OpenFlow. It doesn't have to do with the technology. This now has to deal with internal politics and has to do with compliance and readout, which is issues that are completely different from the things that we're dealing with today.
A lot harder to break in.
It is. It is.
Well, and the how it muddies, you know, you touch on like the politics, but even like at the engineering level, what do network engineers do, and what do software engineers do? We run into that now with the Internet 2 knock now, and so it's the positions have sort of been a little more blended, and it forces you to reevaluate where those barriers are, just everywhere in this interaction. So every function you virtualize, you're going to run into this. If there's a traditional like camp of people that were invested in this, that's going to be a barrier to adoption potentially.
That reminds me of the telco guys.
Over
IP, right?
That is important. I think you're going to have hybrid engineers pretty soon. Not networking engineers, not software engineers, but just like hybrid mode, you'll have hybrid engineers.
So I might take a little bit of a different stance in the enterprise on that. No one I know in the enterprise wants to go roll Java modules to bring services to their network. Because you need to throw up a choke, you need a vendor call in the middle of the night, and you know, the last thing in the world I want to be in is a clip in the middle of the night trying to fix something.
Yeah.
Ben, compile faster.
Maybe it's not working. It's such a missing component in the enterprise right now. There are those applications that are going to say, I want to take this big giant firewall in the center of your network where you're funneling all traffic, where you're paying $500,000 to get 10 and 100 gig through inspected, when most of the time you're saying, go on through anyways, and you're blocking like Telnet.
Right.
Especially in a campus setting. Mm-hmm. So taking that and then distributing that out to the edge, just like it's being done in the data center today. We're just on physical.
Yep.
So who do you guys see? Are there any hardware, any pieces coming up? I know one thing that I'm excited about is Intel. I've actually heard a couple people talk about that here, too. So it's this flexible pipeline. Have you guys dug into that much?
The atomic tables, the flexible pipeline, the FM6000, the fulcrum.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's supposedly a pretty interesting framework. That's what the Arista 7150 is based on, which gives them the ability to do cool things like, you know, for instance, NAP, right? Or other cool things like that. I think that'd be interesting. Now, at the same time, I think, you know, I don't think we'll find an enterprise engineer willing to go in and program flexible tables as well. that's like I think Ed was saying, it's programming an assembly. That could be was an assembly. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I know. You know, a lot of people talk about SDN and commoditization of hardware, and that may be the case. But I still see a lot of innovation to happen over the next 3 or 5 years in the hardware space. You look at once you start having some centralized visibility and control on the kind of things you might want in the chip that you could take advantage of today that you couldn't say take advantage of before. I think there's still a lot of innovation to happen in the chip space.
Yeah, I think so. I think there are probably a couple of NPU vendors down in the exhibition halls that are still trying to find themselves as place and niche. I'm not sure what it is yet, but I think they are definitely trying, right?
Well, and I like the NPU, something Ed said earlier, on flow mods per second. So Gray has ran it on this many times. You've got, you know, we spend $100,000 on a box and we get a dual core processor. And so that's, you know, there's still software components. We might be loading up TCAM that can, you know, is happening at wire. Yeah. But there still is processing component for flow instantiation.
Yeah,
flow
that's true. 1.2 terabits, 10 flow mods a second.
Hi, this is Greg Farrow. Just dropping in here to say that we had to cut a few bits out here before we transitioned to another part where the discussion shifted from flow mods and processing power into a discussion around SDN and wireless. Back to the show.
Because wireless, you know, some of our friends in wireless like to point out that they've had the centralized management piece knocked out for a long time, yet there is no bigger mousetrap on the planet than wireless. You can't forklift one and use the other.
Right. So I think, you know, what we're looking at differently is really building an open platform. And so when you look at the wireless solutions, like you said, I mean, when I first started thinking about OpenFlow and SDN in 2007, 2008, it came from the wireless controller space and saying, look what they've done with a device management, RF management perspective. But they haven't really gotten into the packet control plane yet. I mean, there's some layer 3 mobility, there's some Bonjour stuff starting to come out, but they really haven't started to focus on the things that OpenFlow is really capable of doing, and they don't really deliver those kind of features. And as you said, complete vertical integration, right? You got to buy your access point, your controller, and your management software all from the same place today. And if you're a wireless operator and you want to differentiate your product from someone else's, you want to maybe add some special sauce in there, build some applications on top of that, that's not really easy to do with the current platform. So the idea is really building an open platform that then the wireless operator can come in and innovate and provide innovative services on top of.
Yeah, we've actually at IU, we've we've run into that where the wireless vendors come in and they have, it's like, well, you have to use this management app. You know, we already have an entire suite of management apps my team develops. And so cost savings out the window, right? Because it becomes completely redundant and there's no way to get around it if you want a centrally controlled sort of wireless infrastructure, which, of course, at IU scale, you pretty much have to have. So, yeah, that's a challenge. I'm sure you guys run into it as well.
We're just at the mercy of the vendor.
Yep.
So on some of those, how much of the stuff you're doing at IU? I'm surrounded by Indiana University people.
I know. Yeah. It's all the IU, mafia.
It is the IU mafia.
We have a secret handshake.
Little does anyone know that Indiana is the center of networking, right?
Yeah. It's kind of like we're like the network Illuminati, is that thing?
It is.
Yeah. Well, there's now probably we know. Some people at Stanford that...
I think they might disagree.
Yeah.
And if my IU...
Tell me good reason.
So on that point, how do we open some of this stuff up? Because I know from my perspective, I see a lot of things that are closed. I mean, these guys have... everybody in this room that's really kind of focused on getting the stuff out of the community. Today I heard something about an implementation working group. So we already went through the hybrid working group. Nothing ever came out. I think that's the fundamental thing that's missing right now. I think it opens up a great space for integrators. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think that if we really do want to see adoption, people have to start articulating it and giving tools for us to get there. So some of your open source stuff, is that posted? Is that out there?
Yeah, all the OSS software is Apache licensed, though, publicly available. And we really, what we've attempted to do is use an entire open source stack when we develop these apps and services with Internet 2. That's part of the reason Matt mentioned earlier, the Internet 2 network is a multi-vendor network. And part of the reason there is that you want to challenge yourself to ensure that you are being, you're not just building your applications to the quirks of a specific vendor. And so it really helps in that regard. But, I think part of it is just, to some extent, the users of this technology sort of have to be their own advocates and demanding that certain things are sufficiently open.
And there's increasingly more open source available out there, but, having to... just set up another environment, having changed jobs, set up a laptop, and having to set up my whole lab all over again. The ease of putting all the components together hasn't really, gotten easier over the last couple of years since I set my lab up the last time, right? And so, to your point, I think there's a lot of room for system integrators to come in and help people do that because they do want to get their hands on, but they don't want to spend a week putting together all the pieces and figuring it all out. They want to kind of bootstrap that.
They want some Lego blocks to play with, not
exactly. So there's still some, I think, some work to be done there.
Well, Matt, to play on that, we've been doing some research on the services side of what does SDN mean to services. And as we think about the model for networking moving away from boxes, or meaning that there's a new emphasis on the software as a business model and software as a delivery platform, what we're finding is what that also means is that the services model is changing quite a bit too.
Yeah.
Which means that the services that we start to see evolving look a whole lot more like services that you would buy from Oracle, God forgive us all, than they do of looking like buying SmartNet maintenance from Cisco or from whatever our vendor of choice is.
Yeah.
And so. That's where, to your point of maybe it's an integrator, maybe it is a VAR, maybe it's
a vendor.
Maybe there's some whole new class of professional services that come out of it. But, we're starting to get the sense that that actually may be the bigger revenue opportunity and the biggest service opportunity is in these services.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's actually, interesting you point out that. One of the things that we've learned while doing, developing the OSS application is the amount of time we budgeted for system testing, full, multiple devices, actual controller, HA configurations and all that. The amount of time we needed to do that, we radically underestimated in terms of dialoguing with the vendors and all that. I mean, everybody talks about the simplicity of, you have this spec. How it's a great, elegant thing. You just code to it. You develop with MiniNet, and then you turn and you go, and you point at the real switches,
and it just works.
And then rainbows and unicorns pop out of every corner.
Don't forget about the bacon.
Yeah. And as it turns out, there's so many little tiny subtleties that just bite you, and that the amount of time, and it gets to the campus use case or any other use case where you don't want to. If you're not a geek and sit there and love doing debugging, you're going to want to hire somebody that's been through that. And because that's something that you do it once and it scales to multiple people.
Right.
And that's been one of the hardest things, I think, for us. Is just there's that, that's a steep hill. But
yep.
it's one of the reasons I'm so one of the main reasons I'm really excited to see Open Daylight in its current form is it's got a nice GUI there. You don't have to send REST through curl. You don't have to do, you know, you don't have to build a Java module. You can hook up either Mininet, like you talked about at the OWN lab, or you just grab your OpenFlow enabled switch and now you start punching in flow rules. Really start understanding it. You don't have to be a programmer. You don't have to be a sysdev, you know, any kind of ops guy. So I think that starts to break down because the barrier in the way is, how do we get there? How do we get from A to Z? We know this is cool. We know that some of this makes sense in our environment.
Yep.
But getting there, and I think that's going to need to come from the community and guys like you guys as opposed to a vendor saying, here's how it is. I just don't think they're capable of doing that yet.
And the other thing I should probably roll back and say, in spite of how hard it is to do it today, if we didn't have OpenFlow and you wanted to write it, you write a traditional router running on hardware, what would the learning curve be there, right?
Yeah.
So as much as we can complain now about how this isn't, you know, shrink wrapped and fire and forget and all that, it's still miles ahead of where we were.
And clearly, I mean, the abstraction that it gives you, you know, building on top of that, we've seen over the last few months, just, you know, it bootstraps you. It's a lot faster to start rolling out useful functionality on top of that.
It just makes you more impatient for the next thing.
That is true.
You always want more.
One spec versus 30 RFCs.
Well, and the APIs are not available to you. I mean, the fact is you can look at it. You can't get to it.
Good point. I can't even get something.
You can't even get to it.
I even look at it.
You're not a member.
Exactly. I'm not a member. Well, we'll probably wrap it up there. We'll go around. Matt, what are you up to this week, and where can people find you?
Then you can find me on the Tlac website. Actually, I should have a Twitter account up and coming with a company, as well as a blog here coming shortly.
Really?
I'll be on the show floor. We're doing SDN Idol tonight, and we're handing out SDNU and Demo Friday T-shirts in the meantime.
Nice. So. Excellent. And you're @Wireroy.
You can Wireroy me. I don't take 1.2 flow mods. 1.0, but you're welcome to try 1.0 flow mods. I don't do IP rewrites, but other than that, it's all fine.
Ed, what about you?
Yeah, I'll be here all week. We'll be in the Internet 2 booth during the demo times, showing off OSS and just talking about the AL2S network, and just answering questions as they come.
You need a blog, Ed. You're way too smart to be not blogging.
I feel like I'm drowning already in my to-do list. I know. I resist. I'm old-fashioned.
This is your responsibility to the community. Matt, what about you?
We're here at the ONS all week, and as Roy said, we're handing out T-shirts and meeting with real potential customers around what could they do on SDN, and they can find us at sdncentral.com.
Yeah, definitely go look at SDN Central. You guys do a great job of. I send people there if you don't know what to buy or if there's not a product there. If it's not there, if you're a vendor, you better get it there. And I'm Brent Salisbury. I blog at networkstatic.net. You can find me on Twitter at networkstatic. And that's.